Keep up to date on the details of the biggest court cases happening in Australia. The Case Law Podcast is your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Join me, Stephen Stockwell, as I unpack the biggest trials and share the details behind the headlines with the ABC's best court reporters. We explain how the law works and answer your crime and legal questions along the way. Search the Case Law Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nikki Gemmell grew up in a house covered in dust from the local coal mine. Her father was a coal miner. His father was a coal miner. Her mother was the daughter of a miner, and both of her brothers went into the mines. So when Nikki announced that she wanted to be a writer, she wasn't met with much enthusiasm. But writing was something Nikki really wanted to succeed at. Yes, for herself, but also because achieving was how she'd learned to win her parents' attention ever since they were consumed by a bitter divorce when Nikki was 10. Nikki has now published 20 books, including the wildly successful The Bride Stripped Bare, which she initially published anonymously. Along the way, Nikki met a man, proposed while she was doing the ironing, and started a family of her own. And with her own kids, Nikki, like many of us, has been trying to take the good bits from her childhood while also striving to parent in a radically different way than she was raised, which is not always an easy thing to do. Hi, Nikki.
Hello, Sarah.
What do you remember about your dad coming back from work in the evening?
Well, I remember that he wasn't allowed to clean up in the house. He had to go to the laundry to clean up. So, you know, his hands were black, and it wasn't that he would come back at night sometimes, because he would do a lot of shift work. So sometimes it was that he would come back in the morning. And I can just remember this picture of this man covered in coal dust. And I can also remember he was part of the mine's rescue team down in the Illawarra region. And, you know, sometimes he'd have to go out because there were accidents down various pits down there. So he'd be out at all hours.
Did you ever visit the colliery where he
I
worked?
I did.
What was that like?
I did. He worked at many collieries, but the one when I was growing up, he worked at Westcliff Colliery, which was kind of northwest of Wollongong. They had fantastic Christmas parties. And all the kids of the coal miners used to get amazing presents, so I can remember that. And then as Dad grew older, he'd started off down the pit in the Hunter Valley at little places like Stockrington and around Cessnock. As he got older, he used to take me to old abandoned coal mines around the Hunter Valley as well. So I feel like I got to see working coal mines and then the old ones. I mean, Dad began when he can remember pit ponies. And, you know, Westcliff Colliery, he used to describe it as it had like a highway underground. So the breadth of his life saw so much change in that industry.
And this was something he was born into.
Yes, that's right. So his grandfather, my Poppy, was a coal miner. His dad, Poppy's dad, was a coal miner. It went through the generations. My mum was a coal miner's daughter. Her father, her grandfather, they had been in the coal mines too. So the lineage was, for both of them, a very much a coal mining world.
Was it something they were proud of, that part of their identity?
My dad, yes. He was deeply proud of the working life. My mum, not so much. She always wanted something else. When I think of mum, I think she was this extraordinary, very smart woman she left school at 16. Both my parents left school at 16. I was the first to finish school in my family and to go on to university. But I remember with mum, she always hankered for something more. I think of her, I think she was like, you know, in terms of the grand destiny of ballroom reversal, she was the absolute queen of the dance. She knew how to reinvent her life, whereas my dad had this deep seam of pride at being a coal miner because it went through his family, through so many generations. His dad had left school at 14, but they too were smart men. It was just what was expected of them.
After your dad had washed off all that coal dust in the laundry yes. and come inside, what was he like at home for you as a father?
He was different as a family man to what I knew him as he was older. He was gentler and softer and more tender when he was older. It was like he was allowed to be tender as he became old. When he was younger, he had that image to maintain. He worked his way up in the coal mining industry to be a boss, to be a manager. That made him very kind of hard, a tough man. You know, my family life in primary school, this was in Wollongong, it was, there were hard times. You know, I have this vague memory once of sirens, of the police being called. I remember being so humiliated going to school the next day thinking, oh my goodness, everyone knows that the police came to our house last night.
Because your parents had been fighting?
They had for many, many years. And I perceive that kind of bitterness and anger and my mum's frustration at her life, at the expectancy that she was going to be, you know, a suburban housewife for the rest of her life when she had so much energy to do other things as well. I feel like it coloured so much of my childhood.
Were books a bit of a refuge for you then as a little girl?
Well, they were, but not within the family. So within our world, you know, we didn't have a bookshelf in our house. I can remember Mum had Linda Goodman's Sun Signs, and there was the World Book Encyclopedias, not the posh intellectual ones, Encyclopedia Britannica. Dad, to supplement his mining income, had been an encyclopedia salesman at one stage, and he couldn't sell any except to himself. So we had the World Book Encyclopedias. But it was really through teachers at school, teachers at Kirriville Public, where I went in primary school. They kind of encouraged this huge love of books. And for me, I have two older brothers. It was very much a trail bike world. The bush was our backyard. We lived on the foothills of Mount Kira. And, you know, they had a redback spider farm in the carport of one of the houses that we lived in. And, you know, there were red-bellied black snakes in the gutters outside our house, funnel web spiders in the swimming pool. So it was very much a kind of tomboy world, but my refuge was always books.
How did you start your career as a published author at age 8, Nikki?
Well, my school, my wonderful school, Kirriville Public, had a school magazine called the Kirriville Kookaburra, and the teachers got us kids to type it all up on typewriters, and I had a poem published in it, which is just appalling now.
Do you remember what the subject of this
work was? It was about the circus, and I'd never seen one, so I just made it up. Seeing my name, Nicole Gemmell, and I can't bear being called Nicole now, and it's really only people from Wollongong who knew me in my childhood, who still call me Nicole now. It used to be my parents when they were cranky at me. But Nicole Gemmell, aged 8, to see my name published, that was the first time of like, wow, this feels great. I'd love to do this.
Tell me about the prize you won when you became Ducks of your primary school.
Okay, so by that stage, I had left Wollongong and moved to Sydney with my mother because after this very bitter divorce, she just wanted to get out of this really tight suburban world where everyone knew everyone's business in Kirriville. So we moved to Sydney and I was very fortunate. I became Ducks of that school and I was given a book voucher. And I remember thinking, I don't even know bookshops in Sydney. I don't even know where to go. So on one of my weekend visits to Dad, I gave it to him and I said, you know, what do we do, Dad? And he marched me down to this venerable bookstore called Coddington's, Crown Street, Wollongong. And, you know, we weren't a house of books, so I can just remember him marching up to the wonderful owner behind the counter one Saturday morning, and he was so proud of me. You know, we never really even heard of the word ducks before, but it was like, my daughter's just won this prize and we don't know what to get her. Can you choose something for her? And she took one look at me and she said, I know exactly what you need. And she marched me up to the back of the store, and it was where the classics were. And she slipped out this beautiful leather-bound volume of Jane Eyre. And I can just remember my dad, you know, looking at it and then thinking, right, we need to emboss this because it was leather-bound. So we walked down to Crown Central in Wollongong to one of the key-cutting kiosks where they used to do embossing on leather. And he put my name in it and the date and why I had won it. And I'd never read anything like that. And I still read Jane Eyre every couple of years. It's on my bedside table. And there was something about that writing. It was like the author just reaching out and taking my hand. And I suddenly felt, you're not alone. I just felt like, you know, this person, I understand her and she understands me. And that was another reason why I just felt I'd love to do this. I'd love to be a writer if I possibly could.
It's such a beautiful thing for your dad to do. In a way, he put your name on that book alongside.
No, it's a bit wanky, isn't it?
But it's kind of, it's like saying, yeah, Jane Eyre, you can do your version of this too.
He was so proud.
This move to Sydney that happened after your parents separated.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I mean, this was the 1970s. Divorce still was not common in Australia. How was that for you going through that and watching your parents lead up to that separation? What was involved for you as a kid?
It was incredibly lonely and confusing. And even though I knew that my parents individually were going through hell with the whole thing, I just wanted them to be together. I just wanted a happy family. I just wanted a family around me. I didn't want my whole world kind of cleaved in two. I can remember back in those days, I had to go and testify in court. That's what they did back in the 70s. And I can remember being asked who I wanted to live with and saying, who's best? Or maybe mum. And then thinking, oh my God, I've said the wrong thing. Because the judge basically split the family in half. And he decided, the ruling was that my two older brothers would go and live with dad in Wollongong. And myself, as the only daughter, would go and live with mum. And, you know, I was so young and uncomprehending that I thought this is somehow my fault. And, you know, after a couple of years, it all unraveled anyway. My middle brother came to move with mum in Sydney, but I didn't want to move there. I love my tomboy world of, you know, Wollongong and six and out cricket on the street in front of our road and all the rest of it. And I can remember when I first came to Sydney and driving down the streets and seeing bars on the window on, you know, flats and houses and thinking, what is this place? What is this city? But I must admit, I've never gone back to live in Wollongong again.
Once you'd made that move with your mum in those first years to Sydney, and your dad and brothers were left in Wollongong, what kind of relationship could you have with your dad and brothers in that period? Did you still have much contact?
I did very much, and I must just correct the introduction. It was one of my brothers at 16 went into the coal mines, and the other brother at 16 went to the Port Kembla Steelworks. So they both did apprenticeships, but one of them didn't do it in the coal mines. I revered my dad when I wasn't with him. I longed for him. And my mum was very bitter about what had happened, perhaps with good cause, but I couldn't see that. And I feel like she was often trying to nibble away at whatever kind of love I had for dad, trying to sway me and change me, which only made me love him fiercer. I just wanted everyone to get on. And I still feel like until the day both my parents died, and they very rarely saw each other after they divorced, they came together for my wedding and they came together for my first graduation at university. And I just wanted everyone to let the bitterness go. Dad never seemed to hold that, but Mum did.
Did your dad remarry?
He did. He did. He remarried at 14. I was 14. And a lovely woman up in Newcastle. And I can remember I was a bridesmaid, and I feel terrible to this day. I just started crying at the reception. I don't even know why. And once again, I felt like I'm ruining everything, and this is Dad's happy day. And all I wanted was for Mum and Dad just to be together again. I felt like such a child. And I feel like, you know, I talk about this with my middle brother Paul a lot. We both feel deeply scarred by what happened in our childhood. And that scar tissue is carried with us to this day. And we feel like we will always hold it and have it in us.
Your mum had been keen to make a different kind of life for herself. So what did she do with her new freedom in Sydney?
I didn't recognise it at the time, how magnificent she was. So basically, coal miner's daughter from Cessnock, she'd met my dad in Cessnock High. She had left school at 16, whip smart. I saw that all through my adult life. Such an intelligent woman, meant to leave school at 16. The destiny was to marry a coal miner and have a coal miner's family. They moved down to Wollongong. They had the three kids. It was ostensibly, from the outside looking in, the perfect life. And she was raging inside to do what she really wanted to do and be who she really wanted to be. So for her, divorce was the great liberation. She had to support herself. So she got this job. It was called Telecom back in those days, Telecom in Sydney. And she very quickly, this little Cessnock girl who'd gone to the Wollongong suburbs, worked her way up the corporate ladder, and she ended up right in the centre of the CBD in Sydney, running this kind of incredible studio for Telecom that used to do, in the days before Zoom, like Zoom meetings around Australia. And she was the face of that. I'm so proud of the way she reinvented her life. And she always told me, you know, as a young woman growing up, you must never rely on a man. And she also said, beware of the controlling man out of anything in your life. And I feel like those were the two tenets that she kind of held close to her after her divorce. Her number one aim was financial independence, and she worked and worked and worked.
And it was important to her that you had options in your future that she didn't feel that she had as a girl.
Oh,
was
absolutely.
That part of what was driving her focus on the kind of success she wanted you to have?
Absolutely.
At school?
She felt that education was the way out, and also my voice. So when you hear my voice, it's very different.
Well, what do you mean?
It was interesting when my mum died at the eulogy, because one of my brothers did at the funeral, one of my brothers did a eulogy, and then I did a eulogy, and people were coming up to me and saying, wow, you sound so different. And it's because that was elocution lessons that my mother sent me to way back in the day in Wollongong with this wonderful woman in a wheelchair called Sally Carr. My mother felt that how I sounded and education was the way out, the way into a different life. And so after I became Dux in my primary school, she wanted me to get a scholarship to a wonderful prestigious girls' school in Sydney. And I can remember on the scholarship form, you had to like write down, you know, referees or one referee. And I can remember being mortified because we didn't know like a lawyer or a doctor or a judge or someone venerable. And Mum put down as my referee on that form for the scholarship, the owner of the local bottle shop in Wollongong. And I can just remember being so embarrassed embarrassed because we were a family that didn't grow up, you know, listening to the ABC. It was commercial radio. It was the Illawarra Mercury. It wasn't a broadsheet. It was just so different in so many ways.
Those expectations she had for you, Nikki, to do well at school and mm-hmm. to kind of seize your future yes. by the throat, was that a bit double-edged? Like on one hand, it was, I guess, a kind of encouragement and high expectation, but did it feel like you had to achieve a certain kind of way in order for your mum to love you?
Yes, it's interesting. I feel like we were parented so differently in the 60s and the 70s. It was kind of benign neglect. And that wasn't necessarily a bad thing at all. But I feel like both my parents were so caught up in this very bitter divorce and just working. In a way, my trying to achieve, you know, again and again, from getting that poem published in the school magazine to getting ducks and all that kind of thing, was just a cry for attention in a way. It's like, hey, notice me. Please notice me. My dad told me years later, because he never came to that posh private school that I got a scholarship to. And I always thought, because it was so busy, he was just so busy with his new wife and he went on to have four kids and all that kind of thing, that his first family was kind of neglected or whatever. He was just too tied up in his own world. And he told me decades later, he never came to that private school because my mum banned him from coming because she was embarrassed by how he sounded and how he looked, the coal miner from Wollongong. And here I was at the father and daughter dance in year 12, you know, with mum's boyfriend. And I became ducks of that school too. And, you know, dad wasn't there to see me getting presented with the prize. And it was only decades later that I really understood what had gone down there. Because it was also the era when you weren't, you know, these things weren't talked about. It just happened. So here I was, this young kid, this teenager with his very busy mind, trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah. From a young age, as you say, you had this spark in you about seeing your name in print in the school newspaper.
Oh,
you had this dream. You wanted to write. You wanted to make a mark in this way. When you first said that out loud to your father, your yes. beloved dad, how did he react?
Oh, I can just remember. I just said in my early 20s, Dad, I want to write books. And he just looked at me and he went, oh, waste of time, that. And, you know, that was his attitude, that writing or, you know, things of the mind, that wasn't real work. That was airy-fairy, arty-farty stuff and, you know, you'll never make a living out of that and, you know, you've got to have a proper job and do something proper. So that was his attitude towards my writing.
Well, you did do the serious thing and went to university and studied journalism and got what at the time you thought was going to be your dream job as a news cadet with the ABC.
Yes.
What was it like in reality, Nikki, that job?
I never wanted to be a journalist, Sarah. I'm so sorry to say that. I can remember I ended up in the newsroom in Alice Springs.
These are fought over jobs, Nikki, ABC News cadet. How did you land this if you didn't want it?
I feel terrible. You know what? All through my journalism degree at UTS, I secretly did my passion, which was creative writing classes. And then towards the end, I thought, oh my God, I've got to actually get a job. How terrifying. And, you know, I can't be just some impoverished poet in a garret. I've got mum and dad breathing down my neck to actually do something with my life. So in the last year of that degree, I kind of crammed in like feature writing and radio production and, you know,
serious news stuff.
So I was able, this is really embarrassing to say this, but I was able to go into that interview for the ABC cadetship and say, oh yeah, I've studied journalism. And, you know, I just didn't say that, you know, my main focus was creative writing, but
you convinced someone.
And
they gave you a job. But what was it like for you? I mean, how did you fit in that newsroom?
Oh my goodness, I never felt I belonged because I began in the Sydney newsroom in what is called the dog box, which was basically you start at 4 a.m. police ambulance and fiery scanners, you are listening to all the chatter. You know, can I get a strawberry milkshake from Macca's, all the rest of it, for hours and hours and hours, basically eavesdropping to get stories from them. And then occasionally, I can remember one day it was a police officer had been shot, you know, and suddenly you just instantly kind of, you know, brought to attention by what is going on. It was a baptism of fire in terms of journalism. And I'm quite possibly the only ABC journalist who, when someone came into the Sydney newsroom, which back in those days in the 80s, it was like that was the pinnacle of what you aspired to. I had begun there. And then when someone came in and said, there's a job going in Darwin, does anyone want it? And I thought, yes! It gets me off 4 a.m. It gets me out of the dob box. And it means I can take my writing journals and I can see a place I've never been. And that's been my kind of philosophy through life, to go where I've never been and to just meet people beyond my world. And then from Darwin, I went to Alice Springs. It's kind of like I was working my way into smaller and smaller newsrooms, but I always had the creative writing agenda behind it.
What happened on the drive from Sydney out to Alice Springs to take up that opportunity there?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that was actually several years into my Alice Springs posting. So my dad had an old Holden ute that he sold to me. For 10 grand, and it was manual and I didn't know how to do it. And I needed someone to teach me how to drive from the East Coast across to Alice with this ute that I'd just bought. And a flatmate in Alice Springs said, I know someone. And that's how I met a writer, a wonderful writer in my mid-20s. We fell in love on the road.
It's a long trip.
It's a long trip. It's like 3 days and there are several nights in there, Sarah. So you know what happens when you're in a Holden ute with swags and, you know, under the Central Australian stars. I fell madly, passionately in love with this writer.
So, Nikki, on this 3-day drive in the Holden manual ute from Sydney out to Alice Springs, you fell in love. Yes. and had a long-distance relationship. Yes. For a while there. How did things end between you and the man that you fell in love with on that long drive?
He proposed to me. And for me, you know, I was in my mid-20s. All my girlfriends around me were settling down, some of them having children, getting married, all that kind of thing. It was like, it was just this huge kind of like relief. And I was euphoric. You know, I was madly, crazily in love. You know, my best friend at the time, she said to me, you know, Nikki, I feel like you're fading away with all of this. You're just getting really skinny. And it was like, oh, she's just jealous. Anyway, she had a lot of kind of foresight with that kind of situations. I left my dream place, Alice Springs. At the time, I wrote my second novel, Cleave, about being in Alice Springs, just the land soaked into your bones, the beauty of the place. So I left all of that for this man, this writer, and I moved down to Sydney to be with him. And several weeks after I arrived, he just took me out for dinner and said, I can't do it. I can't go through with it. I had the wedding booked in the chapel of the old school that I'd gone to. I had the wedding dress kind of, you know, talks about all of that, invitations almost chosen, everything. It broke me. It absolutely broke me. And I think it was something to do with, you know, that whole young woman thing of the scourge of perfectionism and wanting to control your life and control the image that you show to the world. Ironically, I didn't write at all when I was with this man. You know, he was older than me. He was a successful writer in his own right. And I subsumed myself. I kind of reduced myself, made myself smaller in a way, because I didn't want to, you know, shine around him in any way in terms of my own writing. So I think if I had stayed with him, I would have stopped writing. But at the time, oh my God, it just broke me.
What advice did your dad give you when this bloke called off the wedding?
Well, I turned into that little girl again. I just remember ringing him. You know, I was in my mid-20s and going, Daddy, the wedding's off. And he just took control of everything. And he said to me, you know what, Nikki, I've gone through heartbreak too with your mother, and it took me 3 years to get over it. And he said, I guarantee you will be the same. And lo and behold, Dad was right. And he said, after those 3 years, you will just walk away and not look back. And Dad was right.
It's so good to have a time frame. So in that heartbreak, it's like, this is going to be forever. So that's just someone to give you a number is like, okay.
Exactly, exactly.
And you didn't just walk away. You sailed away off to Antarctica as a reporter.
Did.
What was life like on that icebreaker and down in the southern wilds?
Look, that was amazing. And you know, by that stage, I was working as a newsreader for Triple J. And some people still think that's all I've ever done with my life, and they still remember my voice from the Triple J days. Wonderful Triple J gave me the opportunity to go down on the Aurora Australis, the Australian icebreaker, which was resupplying the bases, Mawson and Davis and Macquarie Island. And it was the most extraordinary experience. But I broke the rules down there. I was very naughty, but I'm certainly not the only one who breaks the rules down in Antarctica. I fell in love.
And is that forbidden?
Yes, kind of touch. You've got to be very careful, you know, because, you know, it's Antarctica's a bit like the Northern Territory. It's like, you know, when you're there, it's like people, it feels like they're all running away from something, or there's complicated situations back in the real world, back at home. And so you've got to be so careful about that kind of thing. Keep it very quiet. I fell in love with a wonderful, wonderful man, an historical archaeologist called Martin Davies, who taught me so much.
What was he working on there?
Oh, he had the best job. He was going down to Mawson to look at Mawson's hut and to assess it historically. And he was also down there to look at this cairn. He was trying to find this cairn that had been left by the first woman, Caroline Mikkelsen, the first Norwegian woman in Antarctica, and he found it. It was amazing.
So the two of you fell in love and against the rules,
yes,
began a clandestine relationship,
yes,
in,
yes,
Antarctica.
Yes.
He stayed there when you,
yes,
came back to Sydney. How did you stay in touch?
No, it was the very early days of emails. And I can remember it was, you know, I've still got them because I've just finished writing a film with Rob Connolly on Shiver. So I've gone back to all that world. I've still got the penguin quill that he gave me. We just had a very deep connection, and I just assumed I just fell madly in love with him.
What phone call did you get one day from the station leader at Davis Station?
The station leader rang me. And she just said, are you sitting down? And I knew instantly from her voice that, you know, something had happened. Why would she be ringing me anyway? And she just said, Martin's died. He's had a fall. He was an incredible rock climber, and he thought he could do it. He climbed a bluff to read his book, If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. We also connected very much through reading and books. And he fell. And his body was found by his dear friend Sam, and it was just an incredibly traumatic experience.
You wrote that novel, your first novel, Shiver, out of that time,
inspired
by that time. Was it a proud moment for you, Nikki, being able to hand that book over to your dad, who'd cautioned you against writing and the value of writing? How did he react to having this published work by his daughter in his hands?
Oh, he was a funny one. You know, he opened up the book, and I think on the very first page there's this description in the doctor's surgery of you have to be cleared for a medical to go down to Antarctica, and I was describing how the doctor had his finger up my bum. And then there might have been a swear word somewhere in there too. He slammed the book shut and said, right, that's me done. And that was it. He never read anything else of mine again. But I still love him dearly for it. It just wasn't his world, you know.
So it sounds though, I mean, you'd published the book, but my gosh, life must have felt pretty messy at that point.
Oh, yes. The bleak, lonely one-night stands and awful relationships all over the place. That was all my 20s.
You got a phone call then from a man called Andrew. How had you first met one another?
Well, we met, funnily enough, at the ABC. He was in Current Affairs, which is the posh bit of the ABC back then. That's the bit that everyone aspired to, and I was just in news. And we met between our offices in Sydney on William Street. And we actually went out in our early 20s. But Andy by then was in Canberra and I was in Alice Springs. Very complicated love life I've had. And we basically realised I never wanted to be in Canberra. I never wanted to be a political journo. And Andy certainly did not want to be in the desert in Antarctica. So we made this decision we wouldn't have a long-distance relationship, we would part as friends. And I think that was so important to us all through my tumultuous 20s. We were best mates. He's the man who's always made me laugh, and he's incredibly gentle and generous and kind. He's just a kind man. Anyway, when I was 30, he was in London. He was working for the Labour Party in London for Blair, New Labour. And he rang me out of the blue one day. I was 30 and he just said, "God, your life's a mess. Come to London and start again." And I was at Triple J at that stage and I thought, you know what? He's right. It is a mess. And I went to London. There he was at Heathrow meeting me. And it was like, that was the start of the next phase of my life.
I know you mentioned earlier that your mum had an astrology book when you were growing up. I feel you're born under some certain romantic star, Nikki, because by this point I think I would have joined a convent. Like, there'd been so much heartache and disaster and tragedy.
Yes.
And you were willing then to just pack up and move around the world and start again.
All over again, with the printer in my backpack. In those days, I don't know why, I thought, you know, I have to take my printer with me.
There'll be no printer in England.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. But funnily enough, both Mum and Dad adored Andrew. And it was like they could see something in him that I couldn't in my, you know, early 20s in those wild days. And they were just so happy that after all the craziness, I ended up with first boyfriend.
What could they see in him? What was different about him?
I think they could see that he's the most beautiful father. And I think they just knew that after all the craziness, since, you know, I was like 6 years old, I'd had this kind of battering life, that he would be calm. He would just be calm and even in my life. And he would provide this rock of stability. And, I didn't write in my mid-20s, in Alice Springs when I was with the older writer. And it was so hard to write through all the craziness. But I feel like with Andrew, I've had this great flowering of creativity. He lets me be. He does not try to control me in any way. If he can feel me getting a bit antsy or getting a bit shouty or tired with the kids, he'll just say, "Go, just go and write. Just, I will take care of it." He's taking care of the kids now with you. You know, it's like, just go and get it out of your system. So, you know, throughout the 25 years of our marriage, I think it is, we always forget the wedding anniversary and how long we've been married. However long it's been, there have been periods where I've just gone away for like a week or 2 weeks because Andy has said, "You need to write. Just get out of my life. I will deal with it. Just go." He's been the greatest gift in my life.
When you first landed in London, you were working at the BBC.
I was.
How did your dad, what did your dad make of that? He'd never been sure about your writing,
yes,
your fiction, but how did this one?
He could understand that little elocuted voice from Wollongong, you know, on the BBC. That was something that he could get in his head. He could never understand the world of writing. But he was always supplementing his coal mining income. So back in those days, he bought a milk truck. And he was delivering milk at all hours of the morning. And one day he was driving, he was in Newcastle at this stage, and the BBC came on overnight. I think it was News Radio or something on the ABC. And I was presenting a program called Britain Today with this accent. And he heard his little kid. And he got so emotional that he had to pull over on the side of the road and just turn up the radio and just listen to me talking from London on the BBC. So for him, that was like he could understand that and he could be proud of that. And I think he spoke about that moment for the rest of his life.
You say that both your mum and dad saw in Andrew a man that would be a good dad, so it came to be. How quickly did the two of you start a family together?
Well, I proposed to him.
Oh, yeah, tell me about this romantic moment.
You're so romantic. We were both doing night shifts. We were living in this tiny little bedsit off Fleet Street. He was at the Labor Party. Tony Blair had just come in. I was at the World Service, which was just down the road from me. So it was this really weird thing of he would be doing night shifts, I would be doing night shifts. He was monitoring all the media for New Labor. One day I was ironing his shirts really badly, I have to say. I'm hopeless domestically. And I just thought, I want to spend the rest of my life with you. You know, we went out in our early 20s. We were best mates then. We're still best mates. He makes me laugh. And I know that he's kind and he's tender. And so I proposed to him. And he said yes. It might have been the leap year thing. It might have been, you know, 29th of February when traditionally women are allowed to propose to the blokes. So yes, and then we decided to give ourselves a year before we got married, and then we thought we'll just play in terms of Europe and playing in history in London. We just reveled in the whole thing of being young Aussies in London. And then after another year, we decided we'd try for a baby, and then four kids down the track, here we are.
Were they all equally planned, Nikki?
The last one, I have to say, I stopped menstruating at 44 and I thought, yes, the menopause, finally, you know, periods are over. This is fantastic. I can walk off into that great liberation of the postmenopausal woman. And then I realised, I won't say to my horror, but to my shock, my periods had stopped because I was pregnant at 44. And it was like, oh my God. Because I was so kind of on the path of just out, you know, out the other side of babies and all the rest of it. Anyway, that beautiful little boy, that Jago, is such a gift in our lives.
He's a boy after my own heart, because I think my mother had a very similar experience.
Right.
She was 9 years thinking child-rearing had ended for her until I popped up. So these youngest surprises, we bring what we can to make up for the shock we cause our mothers in those first moments.
Absolutely. And I feel like with Jaggy, it's like, you know, it is benign neglect with him, those lessons from the 70s. It's like we're too tired, you know, and we're too busy to be those hovery kind of parents anymore. We just let him go, and he's so self-sufficient and all the rest of it. So I feel like we're finally getting the hang of parenting after the fourth.
Your dad, as you're talking about Nikki, had been this really constant presence, really, of tenderness in your life. Things with your mum were more complicated, really, right up until her death in 2015. Tell me about the lead up to her death. What was going on for her?
Mum had a terrible time in the last 9 months of her life. I've written about this in my book, After. She had chronic pain in her foot. She thinks it was from when she was a ballet dancer in Cessnock back when she was a child. She'd had pain in her foot her whole life. She had an operation to correct it. It didn't work, and this was in her late 70s, and that operation introduced her to opioids. And this was kind of in the days before they became a big thing. So in terms of in the media and all the rest of it, OxyContin. So the last 9 months of her life were this despairing, desperate kind of search to try and ease the pain somehow, the chronic pain that she had. It was like this big bully in her life that wouldn't let her go. She was doctor shopping. She was hoarding pills.
Were you aware of that at all?
No idea. So basically what happened was one day in October, I was at home writing and two police officers knocked on my door and they told me they just found my mother. She died. Suicide, a pill bottle next to her. And I realised as they were saying this and they said, you know, it was OxyContin. And I was like, what? What's that? I didn't even know what that was. And I realised as they were kind of questioning me about Mum, it was like they were like trying to work out what had happened. Was I involved some way? Had I supplied the pills to her in such a great quantity? It was this awful process of trying to understand this whole other life that my mother had that she hadn't really talked about at all. She was a great advocate of Philip Nitschke. You know, occasionally she said, oh, Nick, will you come along to, you know, some of his forums and things? I never had.
This is the euthanasia advocate.
The euthanasia guy. I feel like I wish I had listened more and been with her more in terms of on that despairing, bleak, lonely journey that she'd been on in the last 9 months of her life. I was certainly there present as a daughter, but she wasn't letting me in and telling me what she planned to do. So it was a terrible shock.
It's such a shocking way to lose someone at any point. But I think a parent, you know, at that stage of life, as time has gone on, I mean, how have you pieced it together and what it meant about, I guess, your relationship with her? Has there been any clarity as years have gone by since she died for you, Nikki?
Incredible compassion for her. And I look back now and I think she was magnificent. I couldn't see that as her daughter always kind of banging on the door for attention, you know, like, notice me, I'm here too. She was having an amazing life, doing incredible, courageous things, starting out all over again in terms of financially, socially, emotionally. After she did go through that really bitter divorce, she reinvented herself and she kept on reinventing herself. She became hugely engaged in life, you know, from that woman who just had, as I was growing up, Linda Goodman's Sun Signs, you know, by the bedside and no other books. She just reveled in book festivals and the theatre. She got to Sydney from this small suburban world in Wollongong and she just seized life. She just gulped it. And I loved that about her. And I can see now in hindsight why it would have been so immensely frustrating and tragic for her not be able to do any of that in the last 9 months of her life.
What did you find among her things after she died in relation to you and your work?
Well, she'd always been very circumspect, again, about my writing and never really praising me or very hard on me in terms of what I would do. If there was a bad review, she'd tell me. She'd certainly bring that one out. You know, and I was in London at the time, so it was like, oh, thanks, Mum. I couldn't understand the dynamic of it, but when she died, I found this huge box of newspaper clippings, reviews, press clippings, everything about my writing, and I was just gobsmacked. I had no idea because I thought she'd always been a bit kind of, you know, it's that 70s thing of we're not going to revel in this achievement in any way.
Don't get too big for your boots.
Yeah, exactly. That tall poppy thing, and that's fine. When it comes from your parents, it's a little bit harder, but that's fine. So I was really amazed. And then, you know, her girlfriend said she wasn't like that at all, Nikki. It was just to me, basically. So I feel like within her death, I just learned so much about her, which makes me just think, oh God, I just wish, you know, we'd had a different relationship.
You have a daughter yourself.
My beautiful daughter.
How have you approached that, being the mother to a daughter, having been the daughter to that kind of mother? What has, you know, led your path with your own girl?
I feel like I want to be a different parent. I want to evolve and parent differently, and that I parent almost in opposition to the way I was parented. I always try and learn from what just broke me as a child. And I realized that the thing that absolutely did it for me was weaponizing love, withholding love, you know, silences. You know, there wasn't generosity in love. You were always walking on eggshells. You didn't know what you'd done wrong or that kind of thing. And I thought, with my kids, I never want to give them that uncertainty. I just want them to know that they are my life and I love them unconditionally. And I want them to have that rock. So, you know, that rock of certainty that they are so loved. And I feel like that's the medicine. That's the medicine of parenting, you know, through the benign neglect of the fourth one. He just knows he's so loved and that's what he needs. He's got that. And then my beautiful daughter, who I kind of wrote about her world in Wing. And I just feel like, you know, that's a world of young women with us older feminists, you know, looking at these blazing young women of today with our hearts in our mouths, just thinking, oh, you know, may your spirit never be crushed. And just hoping, you know, that they go on strong with their confidence. I feel like, you know, that whole thing of having confidence and self-belief, that's such an important thing for women, for young women to have. I didn't have it for so long. Yeah, for so long I doubted myself. I almost stopped writing several years ago because I lost that kind of self-belief that I could really do it.
How did you get it back?
Oh, I think I came through the menopause.
The correct one this time.
The correct
not
one.
The fake, not, yeah, the, not pregnancy the pregnancy menopause, one. But yeah, actual, yeah, menopause.
Exactly.
How did it give you confidence?
Well, I feel like going through the perimenopause, I just lost my confidence. I felt I was getting depressed. I put on all this weight that I couldn't shake. My brain had gaps in it. It was like, I can't keep hold of a novel anymore. I've kind of forgotten who the characters are. But there was something, as I was writing, but there was something about the last year or 2 years, I just firmed within myself and I was able to write Wing so strongly and say exactly what I wanted to say about women and young women, everything I'd absorbed in a way since the Bridestrip Bear days. It was just this great kind of like, it's okay. You know, you can come through the rages and the bewilderments of the perimenopause and out the other side is this great knowing calm where you kind of seize that thing of like, I'm going to say no. You know, I'm going to learn how to say no with joy.
Nikki Gemmell, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations today.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It was lovely.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konosky on ABC Radio.
Since we spoke in 2024, Nikki's life has changed course again. She's now the film critic for the Australian newspaper, and director Robert Connolly is adapting Nikki's novel Shiver for the screen. It's going to be the first Australian feature film shot in Antarctica. This conversation was made on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. The producer was Maggie Morris and the executive producer was Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Konosky. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konosky. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.